The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Greg Cockcroft from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is The Atlantic. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from The Atlantic magazine. And we'll start today with an interestingly named story. What Gene Kelly Taught Me About How to Be a Dad. This was written by Noah Galutin. Of the two things that I can claim any great paternal accomplishment for, one is that my daughter, age 3, drinks a collard and dandelion green smoothie almost every morning. The other is that she loves Gene Kelly. You see, we've reached the point where she's old enough for me to start showing her the things I love, which thrills me, in the same way I get excited to tour my own city when someone comes to visit. The guy sells the best carrots and strawberries at the farmer's market. This is the shrimp taco from Morisco's Jalisco. This is Singing in the Rain. If anything was going to spark my daughter's fascination with Kelly, it had to be the greatest movie musical of all time. We began about 30 minutes into the film with Donald O'Connor's rendition of Make 'Em Laugh, the slapstick number in which he runs up and crashes through walls. And soon, she, like O'Connor, was thrusting her elbows and skating across the carpet on her knees. She calls the song Dancing on My Knees. She asked for it over and over until I insisted that we watch something else and skipped ahead to the song the film is named for. This time, Kelly was the star and my daughter was transfixed, the pronounced jaw, the twinkle in his eye. Who is that? She asked. The next night, we started watching the movie from the beginning. It wasn't long before Kelly's character, Don Lockwood, became smitten with Debbie Reynolds' Kathy Seldon, and then he was off, gliding around lampposts and stomping in puddles. But on this viewing, something changed in me. Watching Kelly through my daughter's eyes, his bliss in the soundstage downpour, his body a flexile stack of lean musculature and joyous masculinity, I felt a heavy swell in my core. It reminded me of being too drunk in my 20s, overreacting to something beautiful, and becoming somehow enraptured and despondent all at once. A flood of adrenaline spread from my rapidly beating heart and exited as moisture from my eyes. And I realized that maybe I wasn't okay. I might have forgotten that reaction as a mere aberration. But the next night my daughter asked, "Can we watch more Gene Kelly?" Although she also liked having Mary Poppins and Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory on repeat, she had never asked to see more Julie Andrews or more Gene Wilder. In fact, I still don't think she has registered that Mary Poppins and Maria from The Sound of Music are the same person. But for her, Singing in the Rain was not about Don Lockwood. It was about Kelly. We watched again, and it was as if a protective seal had been peeled off my chest cavity like the lid from a can of Pringles. We watched Anchors Away, and although my daughter was bored through most of it, she sprang to life when Kelly taught the cartoon Jerry Mouse how to sing and dance, and I felt as if I were floating and sinking simultaneously. Another night I put on Les Demoiselles de Rochefort, Jacques Dumay's underappreciated masterpiece, a French new wave homage to American musicals. And although my daughter admired the bright colors of The Girls in the Hats, as she called it, the rest was beyond her. So I tucked her into bed and kept watching alone. The movie thrust forward, and I felt my body nearly levitate when Kelly, now in his 50s, showed up, dancing through the streets, exuding athleticism and glee. But that levitation was quickly followed by a steep decline, and the emotions kept hitting. Perhaps, I thought, this was simply paternal pride. My wonderful daughter, dancing along to Golden Age musicals, opening a floodgate of emotion. Or maybe I was just becoming a cliché, another man of a certain age, who gets suddenly teary at the sight of old, elegant things. But no, somehow these sensations kept felt deeper, like something dormant awakened. Why the hell was Gene Kelly making me feel so much? I had expected fatherhood to change me. I knew it would make me care about my family more than myself. But becoming a parent doesn't automatically remove ego or selfishness. Your baggage carries through even after your kids are born. My wife and I also have a one-year-old son. Even after you think you've grown up and gotten through the worst of it. I had a tendency toward depression in my 20s and early 30s. But historically, and here I'm certain I'm not alone among men, I also tended to bottle it up, put my head down, and deny its existence. I was typically the last person to recognize that I wasn't doing well. Yet, as I entered my 40s, I had become quite sure that I had sort of passively balanced out my emotions, that my condition had taken care of itself. As I watched Kelly gracefully leap up walls and swing from rooftops, however, I realized that balance and stability are related, but not the same. The whole time I had figured that I'd reached an even keel by just getting through it. Prepare breakfast, pack a lunch, take them to school, meet your deadlines, cook dinner, show up, slow up. But what do you do and how you do it are very different things. Singing and dancing perfectly but without joy does not make you Gene Kelly. Or put another way, doing everything but being in a crappy mood while you do it does not make you a good husband or dad. When I didn't complete a task perfectly, I would overreact and beat myself up. Sometimes I would get a little too mad at my daughter, at myself, and beat myself up over again. Kids pick up on energy, and my energy was awful. I sensed that I was standing with one foot shaking on a pinpoint, waiting for the tiniest burst of air from a single jeté to knock me sideways. Kelly, of all people, was the enthusiastic breeze who blew me over, a bellwether, more than an instigator of my emotional state. It was clear to my wife that something was wrong long before it was to me. One afternoon I made a mistake while trying to help her with a project, costing her a couple of $1,000 out of her own pocket. It wasn't an earth-shattering loss, but my error crushed me. I started hyperventilating, so I quickly hid in our bedroom, and then the tears came. When my wife eventually discovered me and held me, I collapsed. I spoke with my doctor about this episode during a routine physical. She had not seen Rochford, but she did refer me to the Harvard Study of Adult Development, the famous long-running analysis of human well-being, and to research describing some people's tendency to hit an emotional rock bottom in their 40s. Much of the research indicates that such declines can happen gradually, or even at different times, rather than coming on as the all-of-a-sudden shock of a stereotypical midlife crisis, which made me think that had I been more emotionally aware, I might have seen my own breakdown coming from a lot further off. Learning about the research was a comfort, in a way, but it didn't exactly cure me. Depression doesn't work that conveniently. Many years ago, I read the actor and writer Stephen Fry discussing depression as being, quote, similar to weather, end quote, as something that comes and goes on its own. This taught me it was something that you have only so much control over and something that you can't explain by just looking at your circumstances or failures. I've since found that the most nefarious thing about depression is that it doesn't simply feed you lies about yourself to make you feel sad. It takes the things that you already feel and are afraid of. You're rotten inside. Somehow that rottenness will seep into your family and supercharges them so that they seem undeniably true. The Harvard study said of depression that it could, quote, Take people who started life as stars and leave them at the end of their lives as train wrecks, end quote. The question I needed to answer, now that I was a father, was how to avoid the wreck. As I worked through my Kelly tumbled feelings, I thought back to that famous number in Anchors Away, when he dances with the cartoon mouse. People can watch the clip on YouTube and marvel at it, out of context, but the reason it exists within the narrative of the film is what strikes me now. Kelly's Joe Brady is a sailor on leave after having received a medal during World War II. He visits the class of a young boy who asks Joe how he got the award. Rather than tell a horrifying truth about the war, Joe makes up a fanciful tale. One day, he happened upon an animated kingdom where the Mouse King, ashamed that he didn't know how to sing or dance, had banned his subjects from doing either. Joe takes it upon himself to teach the king how to do both, delighting the king and spreading happiness to the land, earning his medal. It is perhaps the most joyous suppression of trauma in cinema history. Joe's obfuscation, a touching way to shield those young kids from whatever had happened. I, less healthily, was moving through life in a fog, suppressing my emotions in a way that allowed them to grow like mold. This all twirls in my head as my daughter twirls in front of the TV, hammering home what I now understand as an obvious truth about parenthood in general and my own fatherhood in particular. You can't take care of your family without taking care of yourself. Or rather, you, no matter how much weight you are capable of withstanding, are responsible for the weight you make your family carry too. Many thousands of words have been written by people worried about the state of, quote, men today, end quote, and tussling over conceptions of masculinity. Frankly, I've been less concerned with those arguments and more with figuring out for myself which parts of masculinity, actually matter, especially when it comes to fatherhood. For instance, providing for your family, a traditional tenet of masculinity, is, to my mind, about so much more than money. Fathers provide their children with an example of the type of person we want to exist in the world. It is not inherently masculine to come home angry from work or to drown your emotions in brown liquor. A real man is someone strong enough to admit his faults and mistakes and to strive to improve. The Harvard Well-Being Study notes that the happiest and most satisfied adults in midlife were those who managed to turn the question, what can I do for myself, into what can I do for the world beyond me? This reframing has also made me think more about what helping really means. Yes, it helps the people I love when I cook them dinner, but it helps them a great deal more if I am engaged and present. Never mind if dinner winds up running 20 minutes behind schedule. It's still an absolute point of pride for me that my daughter wants to stay up late watching Gene Kelly. She doesn't know that he was a maniacal perfectionist, that he practiced for terrifying long hours to make everything look easy. She doesn't know that balance and stability do not emerge naturally, but require lots of regular hard work. Those lessons will come. For now, as my kids grow older, I know what I will keep working to show them, that admitting our flaws and failures is necessary, that showing vulnerability is a kind of strength, that ultimately a joyful and open-hearted home is even better for you than dandelion greens. Our second story, Eat More Deer, by Yasmin Tayag. The deer were out there. The crisp tracks in the snow made that clear. 3 hours into our hunt through the frigid New Hampshire woods, Ryan Kalsbeek, a rangy 51-year-old biology professor at Dartmouth, guessed that 200 animals were hiding in the trees around us. Kalsbeek and I were 20 feet up in a pignut hickory, crouching on a creaky platform. his friend Max Overstrom Coleman, a stocky 46-year-old bar owner from Vermont, had climbed a distant tree and strung himself up by a harness, readying his compound bow and swaying in the wind. Shivering in camo jackets and neon orange beanies, we peered into the darkening forest, daring it to move. I had joined Castlebeak's December hunt to try to get my hands on high-quality red meat. Castlebeak had yet to kill a deer that season, but in previous years, he told me, a single animal kept his family of four well-fed through the winter. His young daughters especially liked to eat deer heart. Apparently, it's marvelously rich and tender. My mouth watered at the thought. The last time I'd tasted venison was more than a decade ago at a fancy restaurant in Toronto, where it was served as carpaccio, drizzled in oil and so fresh that it may as well have pranced out of the woods and onto my plate. A bounty of such succulent, free-range meat is currently running through America's backyards. The continental United States is home to some 30 million white-tailed deer, and in many areas their numbers are growing too rapidly for comfort. Each year, a white-tailed doe can typically birth up to three fawns, which themselves can reproduce as soon as 6 months later. Wherever deer are overabundant, they are at best a nuisance and at worst a plague. They trample gardens, destroy farmland, carry ticks that spread Lyme disease, and disrupt forest ecosystems, allowing invasive species to spread. They are involved in tens of thousands of car crashes each year in New York and New Jersey, where state wildlife departments have encouraged hunters to harvest more deer. In especially populated regions, wildlife agencies hire sharpshooters to cull the animals. Last year, New Hampshire legislators expanded the deer hunting season in an attempt to keep the population under control. But the looks of the forest floor, which was pitted with hoof marks and scattered with marble-shaped droppings, that effort was falling short. Over the past decade, some states have proposed a simple, if controversial, strategy for bringing deer under control. Couldn't people like me, who don't hunt but aren't opposed to it, eat more venison? Venison may not be a staple of American cuisine, but it has a place in many people's diets. Health influencers laud it as a lean, low-calorie, nutrient-dense source of protein. Venison jerky sticks are sold at big-box stores and advertised as snacks for people on Whole30 or keto diets. Higher-end grocery stores, such as Wegmans and Whole Foods, sell ground venison for upwards of $12 a pound, roughly twice the cost of ground beef. Part of the reason venison is so expensive is that most of it is not homegrown. It's mostly imported from New Zealand, which has sent more than 5 million pounds of the stuff to the U.S. every year since 2020. Beef, the dominant red meat in the States, has historically been more affordable. But beef prices jumped nearly 15% in 2025, and the conventional kind sold in most supermarkets comes from cattle raised in abysmal conditions. If high-quality venison were cheaper and more widely available, it could be an appetizing alternative. In recent years, a few deer-swamped states, including New Jersey and Maryland, have tried to legalize the sale of hunted venison, which would deliver two key benefits: more deer out of the ecosystem and more venison on people's plates. Despite the sport's association with trophies, many deer hunters are motivated by the prospect of it obtaining meat, and they can only consume so much. It's for your own table, Overstrom Coleman said as he fixed climbing sticks onto a tree to form a makeshift ladder. He had already stocked his freezer full of venison this season. That son of a bitch, Castlebeak whispered once we'd left our companion in his tree, and planned, as many hunters do, to donate any excess meat to a food bank. Hunting is waning in popularity, in part because younger people are less keen on participating than older generations. Efforts to bring in more hunters, such as programs to train women and youth in outdoor skills, are underway in many states. Women are the fastest growing demographic, and they participate largely to acquire food. Moira Tidball, the executive director at the Cornell Cooperative Extension, who leads hunting classes for women, told me, "Still, interest is not growing fast enough for the subsistence and donation system that keep deer numbers in check." It's hard to imagine a better incentive for deer hunting than allowing hunters to sell their venison to stores and restaurants. But the idea is antithetical to a core tenet of American conservatism. For more than 100 years, the country's wild game has flourished under the protection of hunters and their allies, steadfast in their belief that the nation's animals are not for sale. The last time this many white-tailed deer roamed America's woodlands, the country didn't yet exist. To the English colonists who arrived in the New World, the deer bounding merrily through the forests may as well have been leaping bags of cash. Back home, deer belonged to the crown, and as such could be hunted only by the privileged few. Keith Tidball, a hunter and an environmental and anthropologist at Cornell and Moira's spouse, told me, "In the colonies, they were free for the taking." Colonists founded a robust transatlantic trade for deer hide, a particularly popular leather for making work boots and breeches, which drastically reduced the deer population. In Walden, Henry David Thoreau notes a man who preserved the horns of the last deer that was killed in this vicinity. The animals were already close to disappearing from many areas at the beginning of what ecologists have called the exploitation era of white-tailed deer, starting in the mid-19th century. 50 years later, America was home to roughly 500,000 deer, down 99% from pre-colonial days. This commerce-driven decimation of the nation's wildlife, not just deer but birds, elk, bears, and many other animals, unsettled many Americans, especially hunters. In 1900, Representative John Lacey of Iowa, a hunter and close friend of Theodore Roosevelt's, introduced a bill to ban the trafficking of America's wildlife. As Roosevelt, who notoriously hunted to collect trophies, wrote in 1913, "If there is to be any shooting, there must be something to shoot." The Lacey Act remains one of the most binding federal conservation laws in existence today. The law is partly contingent on state policies which make exceptions for certain species. Hunters in most states, for example, can legally harvest and sell the pelts of fur-bearing species such as otters, raccoons, and coyotes. But attempts to carve out similar exceptions for hunted venison, including the bills in Maryland and New Jersey, have failed. In 2022, the Mississippi Attorney General published a statement that opened up the possibility of legalizing the sale of hunted deer, provoking fierce opposition from hunters and conservationists. Today, the option remains open, but has not led to any policy changes. Last year, an Indiana state representative introduced a bill that would allow the sale of hunted venison, but so far it has gone nowhere. The practical reason for such proposals keep failing is that allowing the sale of hunted meat would require huge investments in infrastructure. Systems to process meat according to state and federal laws would have to be developed, as would rapid testing for chronic wasting disease, an illness akin to mad cow that could theoretically spread to humans who eat infected meat, though no cases have ever been reported. Such systems could, of course, be implemented. Hunted deer is sold in some common grocery stores in the United Kingdom, such as Waitrose and Aldi. Notably, chronic wasting disease is not a concern there. Although the sheer abundance of deer make them easy to imagine as steaks on legs, several experts cautioned that some people's affection for the animals runs deep. Deer are cute. They're docile. They're Bambi. David Drake, a forestry and wildlife professor at the University of Wisconsin at Madison, likens them to America's, quote, sacred cow, end quote, as Drake and a colleague have outlined in a paper proposing a model for commercialized venison hunting in the U.S., any modern system would be fundamentally different from the colonial-era approach because it would be regulated, mostly by state wildlife agencies. The only state with a deer-related exception to the Lacey Act is Vermont. During the open deer hunting season, which spans roughly from fall to winter in the Northeast, and for 20 days afterward, Vermonters can legally sell any meat that they harvest. This policy was introduced in 1961, and yet I am not aware of anyone who actually takes advantage of it. Nick Fortin, a wildlife biologist at Vermont's Fish and Wildlife Department, told me. Even after I explained the 1961 law to several Vermont hunters, they were hesitant to sell me any meat. Hunted meat is meant to be shared freely, or at most bartered for other items or goodwill, Greg Boglioli, a Vermont hunter and store owner, told me. During our hunt, I found Overstrom Coleman to be more open to the idea of selling the venison he hunted. I guess that would be a pretty excellent way to share it, he said. By the time the sun went down, the only deer I'd seen was a teetering doe in a video that Overstrom Coleman had taken from his tree and sent to Kalsbeek. Too small to kill, he texted. He'd meet us in the parking lot. The air was glacial as Kalsbeek and I trudged empty-handed toward the trailhead, hoofprints glinting mockingly in the light of our headlamps. From the trunk of the car, we took a consolation swig of wild turkey from a frosted bottle, and Overstrom Coleman, reminded me to visit the next day. I found his chest freezer stuffed with paper-wrapped packages stamped Deer 2025. He handed me three and refused to let me pay for them. Back home a few days later, I used one to make meatballs. Their sheer depth of flavor, earthy and robust, with a hint of nuttiness, made me wonder why I bothered to eat farmed meat at all. We've run out of time for today's episode of The Atlantic. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Greg Cockcroft, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The Atlantic is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.